Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. We're at a fascinating point right now in the music business. Some streaming platforms are continuing to grow and gain subscribers in different corners of the world, but others, not so much. Growth has slowed down and in some cases, maybe even plateaued. But we're seeing a similar dynamic happen on the major label side where some labels have done well and that's been reflected in their earnings, but others, not so much. And their growth is no longer in lockstep with the growth that we see from the streaming platforms that they rely on. And we've also seen considerable growth from the independent sector and specifically the non-major record labels in the business. So it's a great opportunity to take a step back and talk about the entire landscape. To do that, we're joined by friend of the pod, Will Page. He is the author of Pivot. He is the former chief economist at Spotify. And we've talked with him about a number of topics on this episode. But today we take a look at that global landscape. We talk about some of the trends that we've seen. We also talk about globalization and how this trend continues to impact different corners of the world in different ways. But then we also talk about Will's recent report on royalty fairness and the push for completion to be the threshold that's used to count a stream and moving away from the 30-second threshold that has been in place for several years now. So we talk about the implications of that and how that may change music itself moving forward. Will always brings it when he's on the show, so it's always fun to dive into things. So I hope you enjoy this conversation as much as we did. So let's dive in. All right, we're back with the Trapital favorite, Will Page. Welcome back to the show.
The Trapital favorite. I am a supporting act to some of the headline guests you've had on this show, so I refuse to take the word favorite.
We're having this conversation at an interesting time. There's a lot of things happening in the industry right now. So let's start from a high level. What's your take on where music is right now?
It was on the first ever appearance in Trapital where I coined the expression herbivores becoming carnivores. And to learn that the Conservative Minister for Culture here in the UK government quoted me from the Trapital podcast shows how far your show has gone. You have a Heineken effect then, Runcie. You're reaching parts other people can't reach with your podcast. But the key point here is we're definitely in carnivorous territory now. And we know that anecdotally, I think in America especially, we're seeing that some streaming services, namely Spotify, seem to be racing ahead while others seem to be faltering. And now we know that factually based on the last stock price scare from the Universal earnings call, where there was moderate growth in streaming revenues reported, and very quickly analysts were doing backward reduction and working out if Spotify's fine and YouTube's fine, that must mean that on the other side of the fence, things are not fine. And again, back to copyright Dan Runcie Trapital, herbivores becoming carnivores, this is definitely carnivorous territory now, where a lot of people's gain is a lot of other people's pain.
When we had that conversation, we knew that there was going to be a saturation point. But in different markets, you have different reach. And especially if you have certain digital service providers that have higher saturation in some markets versus others, and while others may have more of a global reach, the mix can start to look quite different. And I think that's where for years you saw everyone grow in tandem, whether it was the DSPs or the major record labels. But this is what the carnivore shift looks like. Everyone is going on a slightly different path based on what their strategy and mix looks like.
Bingo. And let's just build out another analogy, which goes long before music streaming, peak oil. Peak oil is when you've extracted more oil than there's left to extract. And what left to extract is costly and expensive to get out the ground. That's the concept of peak oil. And I think we're at that stage. Now, I just use very round numbers here. The first 100 million music subscribers, actual paying music subscribers, not account holders in America, were predominantly iPhone, iOS. The next 100 million will be Android. And that's a great example of peak oil. That next 100 million is going to be a lot tougher to get out of the ground. So we have that influence in the market. And I think then you can look back at the streaming services and ask which of these services are best placed to tackle that Android market, that Android oil extraction, that Android fracking, you could call it. And I'd know which horse I'd want to back in that race.
For you, I have to assume that this is timely because you put out this report every year, your global music copyright report, and some of these fluctuations in the market have had some people questioning, what does the future of this industry look like and where are we heading? You share the global copyright number that you had last year, over $40 billion. I have to assume that number is going to continue to grow, but based on some of the rhetoric I'm not quite sure that everyone is convinced on that.
Yeah, thanks for flagging that global value of copyright work, and thanks for the continued support across what a 2 to 3 year period you've given that work. It's a passion project for me. I'm not charging for it. I'm driven by education. I believe a better educated business can become a better business in itself. And to say 40 billion, a number that begins with a 4, you think where we started this journey in 2014, that number began with a 2. And I think the question we can ask on Trapital is, based on that work, based on all the analysis that goes into it, how long before it begins with a 5? Are we looking at 2 years, 3 years, 4 years? I don't think it's that long away, because you're seeing the emerging markets really pick up. We're more railroads and we're running more trains. We're seeing more expansion into markets like Vietnam, for example. That wasn't even on our radar. More expansion into markets like Africa. And we're seeing some serious traction there. The way that record labels, credit to Universal especially for their international strategy, it's really impressive how they're putting boots on the ground into these markets and developing them. Yes, we have a headline figure that we'll keep coming back to, that will keep on getting bigger. That's exciting. I think one of the best undercurrents, if I use that term, that work gives the reader, gives the listener to Trapital, to the inquisitive minds that listen to your podcast, Dan, is a split between labels and publishers. Now, you have a pie, the global value of copyright. How do you divide that pie up between labels and artists on one side, publishers, songwriters, and their collective management organizations on the other? And when I first did this work back in 2014, it was pretty close to 50-50. Today, it's more like 2/3 to the record labels and artists, 1/3 to the songwriters and publishers. And that's simply because consumer revenues, that being streaming revenues, favor labels more than they do publishers. So that recovery has tipped the balance. And I think what you can do on this podcast is take that balancing act. One's an apple, one's a pear. They have different copyrights. They have different legacy effects. But just look at the balance effect and ask, what headwinds and tailwinds are going to affect this balance going forward? Let me give you a quick couple of examples. Think about the potential for the balance to become more favorable to publishers as more labels perhaps use discovery mode to compete for label share. There's a scenario. So I'm going to reduce my effective revenue share from the streaming platform to grab more market share in the platform. As carnivorous behavior plays out inside the business, we might see the label portion go down. Therefore, relatively speaking, the publishers would go up. We could also look at the publishers and say, look at the deals they've managed to secure from TikTok, from Peloton, where they're getting far better share of the copyright value than they were from streaming. That's encouraging. But equally, what about the audiobooks dispute with Spotify? So let's say the judge rules on audiobooks one way or the other. That's a man-made decision versus nature is simply, on the 8th day, God gave us collecting societies, ASCAP, BMI, and so on. It took several decades, if not 100 years, before we built Sound Exchange. So how much is just the lay of the land and how much is our actions which is causing this imbalance in the value of copyright?
It does make me think back to the globalization topic we've talked about on this podcast before. Where do you think that trend continues to grow and evolve, especially as the herbivore market is becoming more of the carnivore market?
Again, hat tip to Trapital. You've also championed this unpronounceable, tongue-twisting word, localization, like no one else. The latest trends, which I published in March, was looking at the same 10 European countries as before. And the leading headline was, bigger European countries see the biggest effects of localization. So you're looking here at France, Germany, Poland, Italy, especially Italy, and Sweden too, all seeing huge dominance of local artists topping their local chart in their local mother tongue, contrary to what globalization theory would have predicted. Globalization, to remember, says the world is flat. We all shop at McDonald's. We all go to Starbucks. Big American brands win. Localization says the world isn't flat. These local artists are going to rise to the top of the local charts on global platforms. That's the twist to this tale. Not on local platforms, but on global platforms, we're seeing local rise. I would drop 2 grenades into this debate. The first one is to dispute my own headline, bigger European countries. I'm going to go to Denmark. Denmark is a country of, what, 5.6 million people. Beautiful country, incredibly efficient run country. Now, this is a small European country with its own mother tongue. Swedish and Norwegian people don't understand Danish, let's just be clear. 9 of the top 10 artists in Denmark last year were Danish, singing in Danish. It's incredible. Now, where do you want to take that? What I found interesting there was record labels would be saying to artists, okay, we've got some great material here. Let's go into the studio. Let's make this record. Let's put all our marketing power into you to make you a star. But if you sang in English, at least the Swedish people across the bridge could understand you. And the artists are saying, thank you, but no thank you. I'd rather sing in Danish, please. And I find that conversation, which is a sweeping generalization, but broadly reflective of what's going on there, to be fascinating for me. The artist is seeing a trade-off. I can go local and sell my music to 5 million Danes, or I can go global and the market opens up to 8 billion people around the world. And they choose local. So I started exploring this topic. And if I stick with hip-hop, a genre that's definitely home turf to Trapital, what I learned was Danish artists know that if they all rap in Danish, they don't have to compete with Western stars. It's like a collective decision, almost like genre protectionism. If we all rap in Danish, we're competing with each other. And that's a much more level of playing field than if we're competing with Lil Uzi Vert or the new Eminem record that's coming out from the States. That I found to be jaw-dropping. Blowing. So if you go to a hip-hop festival in Danish, you're going to be singing those songs in Danish because that's how the bookers are going to be booking the acts. A very clever strategy.
Let's talk more about this one, because Denmark is also a great example of these artists having riches and niches, because only 5 million people, as you mentioned. But if you look at the price for streaming on a monthly basis, Denmark is the country that I believe is the highest. So these artists are able to generate streams from the people that are speaking and listening in their native tongue, and those streams end up being worth quite a bit of money for them.
You said riches and niches. I love that expression. I'm going to be borrowing that a lot. You're going to get interest paid on that quote. But yeah, when you say rich, Denmark is rich. If you go on a holiday in Denmark, be prepared to look at a lot of menus, but you do not want to do the division and work out how much that meal is going to cost. But yeah, let's just build that point out. I think perhaps, and I don't want to put words in the mouth of artists, this is a complete different country to the one I'm from, but maybe you have that big fish in a small pool versus a small fish in a big pool trade-off. That's the trade-off. But let's think, how big can you get in that small pool, and how small will you be in that big pool? Riches and niches, if I can pronounce that correctly. This is a very rich musical country, and people are working out that being a rich big fish in a small, very rich pool perhaps is the right way to go.
A very rich pool, in that it isn't just rich small pools like Denmark, it's also large, massive pools like Brazil. So we'd love to hear a bit more about that one.
When we pick up on globalization and travel from Denmark in the north of Europe down to Brazil in the bottom of Latin America, what we're seeing there is quite simply off the charts. I was addressing a very relevant audience to how Brazil works and talking about globalization. And the person in the front row of this very relevant audience said, "Now, Will, I want to fact check you for a second." "Okay. I just want to understand what we mean when we talk about this word localization. So I'm going to look at the YouTube music charts in Brazil." Okay, I'm live on stage here. I've got a heckler in the front row. I'm wondering what's going to happen next. He said, "I'm going to look at the YouTube music charts and tell you when I find an English-speaking artist, okay?" And I'm thinking, God, this is where I get shown up for being a fool and my theory's full of bullshit. And he's rolling down his phone. When he gets to an artist, he says, "Got it. It's Bruno Mars." Okay, Bruno Mars, top English-speaking artist in Brazil, fine. And then he says this. He says, "And his rank is number 86. And I literally fell on my fat ass. Are you telling me that there's 85 artists above Bruno Mars who are singing in Portuguese?" He said, "Yep. For all those record labels in London and New York and Santa Monica, good luck breaking English-speaking artists in Brazil, people, because I can update this with a fascinating fact, which is today there is no international artist on the YouTube chart in Brazil, no Spanish-speaking and no English-speaking. It is entirely in Portuguese." It's breathtaking.
That's impressive. And especially impressive, too, that it's all Portuguese. Sometimes people lump together Latin America. They may assume there may be some Spanish-speaking artists. But no, we're talking a country with well over 200 million people. And these are the results that you see.
I was just taken aback by it, to the point where you really have to wonder, is this the shape of things to come? So previously, record label has an international marketing strategy. The artist sings in English. Things are going to be easy. We'll do X amount of business at home, a Y amount of business abroad. And then the sort of political map of the world, you have to start scoring off countries where you're simply not going to make the inroads that you used to make. the global pop star could become an endangered species in the future. When you talk about global pop stars, true global pop stars where, let's say, one in three teenage girls around the world could sing at least one of their songs, that level of global pop stardom. If you were to draw up a list of who qualifies as a true global pop star over the past, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, a bit before lockdown and a good bit after, let's say that, how many of that list then, how many of that list in your head would have come from Disney? If you go through your list, Olivia Rodrigo, Ariana Grande, Sabrina Carpenter, Justin Timberlake even, Disney is the secret source for what's producing these global pop stars today, and Disney is not a record label. Record labels take what Disney produces and take them 40 yards further upfield, but I think the role of Disney here in terms of counterbalancing localization effects is going to be an interesting one to come back to in a future chapter episode.
That is definitely one to come back to. How much of this is based on algorithmic plays, where if they see that you like one or two artists that are Portuguese and you're based in Brazil, are they suggesting more Portuguese music for you for readback listening, things like that, versus how much of it is being selected by that particular person?
I think the algorithm is so important to this discussion. You have to approach it carefully. I'm going to quote Rory Sutherland, a famous advertising executive from Ogilvy. He says, where does all data come from? All data comes from the past. It can only reflect what's happened. And the algorithm trains off the past. And if the algorithm knows that Dan Runcey loves Danish language hip-hop, the algorithm will prepare more Danish language hip-hop for Dan to consume. So I think the algorithm can contribute to geographic echo chambers, for better or for worse, past. What the algorithm doesn't know to Dan Runcey living in Copenhagen is if I played Dan Runcey cumbia music from Colombia, he would flip the F out, because that would be the future. That's the role of a human DJ.
Right. It's that ongoing balance of giving the person what they want because that's what they continue to listen to or have listened to in the past versus giving them an ear for what they may enjoy in the future. And I think we'll continue to see that balance play itself out as streaming continues. But on the topic of streaming, we should talk about another report that you put out recently, which is your report on royalty fairness and what the model should look like moving forward. You put out a report recently that made the call for completion. Completion meaning that we should be compensating songs and by extension, the rights holders of those songs based on the song itself actually being completed, not hitting a 30-second threshold, not hitting a certain percentage of listening from start to finish. And I read through the report and I also saw a lot of the response to the report. And one of the things that you did, which you often do, which I respect you for, is you did the Eminem and 8 Mile thing of before you even start with your rebuttals and your whataboutisms, let me tell you all of the counters that you may have to this particular point.
This is a music industry. This is a music industry.
You knew who you're dealing with. First, let's talk a bit about the report itself, but then I do want to hear how helpful that was for you in laying out all of the rebuttals before they even came.
Well, it was noticed. Let's put it that way. One senior record label executive said to me, I can't fault you for it because you faulted it yourself. Now, if anything happens from this project, what I hope it does is it raises the level of debate when people put forward arguments. They consider strengths and weaknesses. The first whataboutism that came up is, aren't you going to penalize longer songs? And what I was able to show was long songs wouldn't be discriminated against because they're as completed as shorter songs. People who want to hear shorter songs do so and complete them to the same scale, to the same extent as people who want to hear longer songs. They opt for longer songs and complete them too. The completion rates, broadly speaking, are around 85 to 90% of all music after 2 minutes. Between 1 and 2 minutes, the skip rate is roughly speaking around 60%. Only 40% of songs between 1 and 2 minutes of listening time are completed. But once you get past that 2 minute horizon, which is broadly speaking what you'd expect for music today, completion rates, they're broadly similar across time. But I think the greatest strength of my proposal is it brings incentives. Let's think about it for a second. We've had flat money coming into the music industry from streaming subscribers since 2001, $9.99. As we said on our podcast where we were discussing the Lil Uzi Vert case study, well done creating super fans on the pro rata. Do you know how much they're worth? Exactly the same as everyone else, because the law of averages make it that way. I would argue persuasively that a skip is a negative signal. the curators at the streaming platforms use skips as a negative signal. If there's a lot of skips in that playlist, you didn't curate that playlist well enough. It's a negative signal. And I'm penalizing the act of skipping. I'm not promoting completion. It's asymmetric. If you show intent, that is, if you skip songs in my model, I intervene in the market. I start to punish those skips and therefore promote completion. If you do nothing with your listening experience, I do nothing with your royalty structure. So what the model does is it sneaks incentives in through the back door to a business that's been flat in its money coming in, money coming out situation for 23 years and counting. And I think that's a strong point. The other footnote to that, which I'm passionate about, is I take 31-second stream fraud, those click farms in the Philippines, in Indonesia, in the south of France, apparently, and I whack them. So that explicit stream fraud of 31-second streams again and again and again gets killed overnight. I want to go Scarface, say hello to my little friend on that one, because that needs to end yesterday. So I'm really proud that A, I've got incentive properties into this model, and B, I tackle stream fraud head on as well. Forsters will still fraud, but I take the obvious one, the low-hanging fruit, and I whack it hard.
Let's talk more about the streaming fraud piece. Under the rules of completion, someone could release a 31-second song, and that still could go through to completion. So how do you see this addressing that?
Sure. So you have to be a little bit careful what you say about the battle against fraud in a public space like a podcast or on a stage, because if you give away the ammunition you're using to fight fraud, the forcers are going to be listening. But firstly, introducing the third threshold to the stream model, that is, we have two already. Has Dan Runcie pressed play legally and technically? He's passed that threshold. He's pressed play. Has Dan Runcie streamed 30 uninterrupted seconds, which could, by the way, be anywhere in the song? Introducing this third one, which is, did he get to an end, produces a valuable weapon for the fraud detection teams to catch fraudulent behavior faster. So all I believe you can do with fraud is speed up detection rates and remove incentives. That's all you're really trying to do if you're in a fraud team. I'm sure there's other things going on that we can't say on the podcast, but just stick with those two as we can air them publicly. What drove this proposal was to do something that the accounting teams, the royalty accounting departments and the record labels, the publishers, the streaming services can actually implement. What I believe with completion is this is doable. And what the industry needs is a baby step. Get me to base one. Let me implement it, and then we'll move to base two. If you want to pursue artist-centric or user-centric or artist growth or thresholds after this, you can. But introduce this as the baby step to base one, first of all. Let's lay this as a foundation to get us on that path.
Right, because this is something that could exist in whatever model that you choose. There are already trade-offs that are happening with pro rata, with user-centric, or with artist-centric. So now that we've talked about the length of the song, let's talk a bit about the source of streams, because that's another big factor with this.
Sure. The second most common whataboutism I've got is, wouldn't you be just favoring lean back music? Firstly, we have data, quite eye-opening, illuminating data to present here, which shows that, yes, lean back source of listenings have got higher completion rates than lean forward ones. Obvious, because you've got to lean forward to skip. But not by much. They're all up there in the high 70s, low 80% range, so it's not that big a discriminatory factor to consider. But I want to push it back and say, would that necessarily be a bad thing? This is a consumer-centric proposition. The consumer pays for convenience. Consumer pays to be served music that the platform will choose for them. It's like going to a restaurant and realizing that you don't have to look at the menu in order to get your food. So I think lean-back listening has a value proposition that we sometimes forget about, and that is that the consumer is paying the convenience of not having to choose what they want to hear. And having to lean in could be an inconvenience, and having to skip would be a double inconvenience, and that's the one I intend to punish.
Let's take a break for our Chartmetric stat of the week. One of the topics that you're going to hear us talk about in this episode is a case study that Will had recently done on the legendary singer-songwriter Carole King. I don't want to give anything away just yet, but the biggest hit that she has, It's Too Late, is one of those staples that you always hear getting played on U.S. terrestrial radio stations, and you might have been hearing it a little bit more often than usual. In the past year, that song has had over 21,400 airplay spins, and that's a number that has grown nearly 33% in the past year. When people talk about timeless music, this is the kind of song that they're talking about. Let's get back to the episode. Talked a bit about completion, but what completion trends look like, specifically around age, but also around genres. So let's talk a bit more about
that. Sure. Working with Glenn McDonald, formerly of The Echo Nest, again, the author of that fantastic book, You Have Not Yet Heard Your Favorite Song, we looked at the age of listener. But what we did see was a cutoff point, which was people who are 35 years or older were more likely to complete. Not a lot more, but there was definitely a watermark there that you could touch on. And my best guess here, which is we've had streaming for, what, 15 years-ish? So perhaps those people were aware of music listening prior to streaming have a greater tendency to complete. Your thoughts?
Certain audiences and certain generations have slightly different behaviors. In the CD era, or even in the tape era, sure, there were skips, but it wasn't as easy as just pressing a new button on Spotify. And there also wasn't this generation that was competing with TikTok, competing with all these other things, that 35-year cutoff. So we're talking about people that were either born before or after 1989. This is the middle of the millennial generation. That generation was more likely to grow up with lead back listening and the type of on-demand content that is now common today for young people that a lot of us didn't grow up.
I love going back and forth on this. Those people grew up in an age where skipping a song had consequences because you had the album. There was only maybe 7 or 8 songs left to listen to. Now when you skip a song, you have unlimited songs to listen to. There's no marginal cost to a skip, hence the more prevalent. We also looked at age of track. We did see this tendency towards shorter songs develop from 2018 onwards. That is, we know songs have got shorter, but when did they start getting shorter? We never knew that until we came on Trapital today. Now we know. So I turn it back to you, Dan Runcie. Why 2018? What happened in 2018 when we started losing our attention spans?
By 2017, 2018, you started to see the hyper rapid growth of the streaming era and Spotify. This is when you started to see double-digit growth year after year. And not just Spotify, to be clear, it was the other DSPs too. This was also around the time where a majority of the recorded revenue in music industry coming from streaming versus non-streaming sources. But by 2018, you're talking the influence of Rap Caviar and Playlist
Tumabasa
are in full swing. So, yep, shout out to Tumabasa, the originator.
Respect the architect. This is grand stuff. So let me move to the final rabbit hole you can explore with the completion, which is genre, or not just genre, but if you go to Every Sound at Once, this incredible website Glenn McDonald built, which has, I think, 6,000 meta-genres, we looked at completion by meta-genre to see what we could unpack. And again, the headline, as it was for the other variables you could throw at this machine, was that it's a non-discriminatory factor. Jazz and classical has some of the highest completion rates of them all. Song length, genre is not a factor. But if you go to the meta-genre level, couple of interesting observations. The most completed music there is on streaming services today is children's music and religious music. Kids want to get to the end, so there's hope for future generations. And people with beliefs, they get to the end as well. Now, I'm not saying this is a large part of the streaming pool here. This is our niche genres. But I turn it back to you, Dan. Why children?
I think the other thing with the kids too is the parents put on those playlists for the kids, and then they are tending to the children while they are letting the music on in the background. I have to think about my own daughters with the two kids we have here, which is very different than me listening to my own music, and I am staring at the phone, I'm looking at it. There's other things that may be interrupting my attention. The religion one is interesting. There could be a bit of correlation there with age too. At least in the United States, older generations do tend to be much more religious than younger generations do. So there could be some correlation there.
I think if you look at page 468 of the Bible, it says, thou shall not skip.
Of course. How can you forget the book of Spotify? The Bible.
But you step back from all of this, the age of listener, age of track, meta genre, source of streams, which is featured in the proposal. Stream duration. If this idea is to be endorsed, if this idea was to be implemented, then I genuinely think it puts music industry into a better place. And that makes me excited.
With that, though, we should talk a bit about a case study that you had put on my radar. You had done some work looking at Carol King's catalog, which is probably a little bit different from how a lot of artists in the streaming era, when you look at where their revenue comes in from.
Sure, Dan. This goes back to the biggest breakthrough of last year, which was not the global value of copyright, but the fact that DJ Will Page's Mixcloud set got to number one on Mixcloud worldwide with 56,323 unique listeners. No fraudulent click bots in that count, I can promise you. And in that mix, I do believe when I drop Coy Leary and I mix her with The Message by Dave McCullum, there's a shout out from a certain Dan Runcie as well. So thank you again for the support on the mix as well as the economics. You do both, the show and the business. But yeah, I got to work with Carole King, which was phenomenal. My thanks to Sherry Condor, to Mark Setloff, her PR agent, for the cooperation there. When you look at an artist catalog, what you tend to see is, let's call it a 5-95 rule. This is the top five tracks of an artist will generate 95% of their business. Therefore, the next 680, 740, 1,000 tracks that sit on that platform generate only 5% of their business. I mean, think about that. These catalog deals where I'm buying this artist's entire catalog, sir, you only need to buy 3 or 4 ISRC codes to get the lion's share of their business. There may be another way of approaching this. I've long argued that, and the gaming industry, by the way, really gets this point. They don't want catalog, they want yield from tracks. If we accept a 5-95 rule, I looked at Carole King's discography, and what I noticed is that if you look at her top 10 albums or the top 20 albums, sure, Tapestry is there, but the lion's share of them are all greatest hits compilations. 9 of her top 10 albums are greatest hits. What does that tell you? It might just be the release strategy from the label, reissuing greatest hits again and again, but it tells you she's got a body of work. It's not a one-hit wonder. It's not a two-hit wonder. This woman has got so many hits over so many years. So I produced a sort of waterfall chart which looked at her top five songs. Her top five songs generated only 50% of her overall demand. I think what that tells you is she's got the greatest body of work I've ever seen in my entire career in the music business.
Is there anyone else that comes to mind when you saw this study? I think there's a time frame of when she released her music, 70s, funk, folk rock, made me think of other artists like a James Taylor. It's not something that you would see from a contemporary pop star today, but there's something about that time frame that does make it really unique.
Yeah, there's a handful of artists which come to mind. The first one is the obvious one, the Beatles. I would love to try and replicate this analysis for the Beatles and see where that stands. It may show a beautiful body of work. It may not. Let's remember, the Beatles joined Spotify late. And it might be the case that those 2 or 3 hits dominate their streaming portfolio. If I can just flip formats for a second very quickly, one interesting spin out of this is to go back to the vinyl debate. If you think about vinyl, what's fascinating with that is they do pay all songs equally, regardless of the killer and the filler. If you go back to the 50s and 60s, Mafia would pay to get artists on the B-sides of big records because you'd get so much money back on the publishing. So my favorite example of that is the greatest vinyl record of all time, which is Saturday Night Fever, famous for one song and one song only, Staying Alive. And I think track 16 is Ralph McDonald's Calypso Breakdown. Nobody on planet Earth has bothered to listen to Ralph McDonald's Calypso Breakdown, even if you bought the record, even if you have 2 record players like I do. You don't play Ralph McDonald's Calypso Breakdown. It's incredible to think that Ralph McDonald's Calypso Breakdown got the same publishing value as the Bee Gees Staying Alive, because that's how vinyl worked. Now vinyl's coming back into the game. We should refresh Ralph McDonald. We all want to be Ralph McDonald's now.
Do you think that part of the distinguishing factor with Carole King also is the generation of listeners that she reaches on streaming services and their behavior habits for how they listen to streaming music? For instance, if she's reaching a lot of the baby boomer and maybe the older Gen X generation, there is more likely to be a lean back listening behavior because that's how they historically listen to music, as opposed to some of these newer artists topping the charts that are very much want to click this song, I want to stop this song type of behavior that we see more often from Gen Z.
I think you're onto something there. If I could maybe take your brain in a slightly different direction, though, I think if we use the term hand-me-downs, when parents hand things down to their children, one of the things I'm really bugging in my bass bin right now is when music reaches all generations, not just some, all members of the family, not just one or two members of the family. If I bring it right up to date for a second, Imagine Dragons back in 2017, 2018, when they started breaking, if you looked at concerts, they sold tickets in blocks of four or five because the entire family would go to see them, not just the son or the daughter who loved the band. This is something really big in our business, really big. If you want to stand above this increasingly crowded market, if you want to get noticed, I think there's a family strategy, not a family plan, a family game going on here, which is, can you produce music that appeals to all members? Going back to Carole King, I would say it's almost like a rites of passage as a parent that you pass her songs down to your children. I really do. I think, and that might be part of the secret source as to what's happened here. Every parent has a favorite Carole King song, and every one of those parents wants their children to grow up on it too.
It's four-quadrant music, right? Like they talk about in show business. What can reach your audience? Older, younger than 25, and both men and women. Definitely a lot to continue to dig into there, and it'll be interesting to see how this conversation develops. But we should revisit a few things that you have coming up. And I want to talk a bit about Australia, because that's also an interesting market, especially with globalization and a lot of trends happening there. So let's dig in there and some of the things you may be covering there.
It's an interesting market for you, Dan, because Traptal is big down under. The number of people that listen to Traptal in Australia is phenomenal. If you're an English-speaking country and you're not America, let's just start with my own country, Britain. You know that I don't think we've had a number one British artist in the British chart this year. I think George Michael last Christmas just qualifies, given the cutoff points. But apart from that, we're still waiting for a British number one. And in Australia, I think you've had 3.5 years where you've looked at the album charts and not seen a new Australian band. So they use the word drought. So I'm going over there to explore symptoms and cures. What is causing this? Is it the quality of the music? Nope. Great music coming from Australia. Is it the record labels? Is it the geography? So you're like a doctor exploring symptoms, trying to get to what is holding back Australian bands in their own home market. And then what could possibly be the cure? So I'm really looking forward to going down to Sydney to present that work to that audience because they badly need it. They definitely need help. The bands are great, the music is great, but something's gone a little awry in this streaming journey, which has no precedent before it. And the presence and prominence of the Australian bands has definitely suffered, so we need to look at ways of fixing that.
Are there any other English-speaking markets or countries where a similar dynamic exists?
I would imagine Canada could be one, but then if they avoid these effects, you could say, is that because they're right next to America and most of these artists signed to American record labels? Or you might want to argue, is it because of the incredible support the Canadian government gives their musicians? Again, back to symptoms and cures, correlations and causations. Gets interesting, but if I leave the English-speaking world, the two more fascinating examples for me are Spain and Portugal. There's no Spanish or Portuguese acts in the Spanish or Portuguese charts because they're all Latin American or Brazilian, which is fascinating. And the Portuguese government is now getting worried that kids today are speaking Brazilian versions of Portuguese. Because of the influence of media, which I think is a good thing, because Brazilian Portuguese is way more romantic than Portuguese. Beleza. But what was that expression you gave us earlier on in the conversation, rich and niche?
Riches and niches.
Well, think about those artists coming from Puerto Rico or Colombia, I would say, relatively speaking, poor countries, who are seeing their music export to richer markets. Imagine what their royalty statements look like when those rich monies come back to those poor countries' destinations. There's a whole exchange rate thing going on there, which we should not be naive to. This is big.
I see a Bad Bunny breakdown in your future. So, Will, before we close this out, is there anything else that we should cover or share?
Sure. I'll just reiterate with the way I built my website, pivotaleconomics.com, was there for the students studying the music business, there for the professionals working in the music business. It's a resource. It's a private good for public consumption. So, tell all your listeners, you know, Traptal's unique. It's the sum of the parts. It's not just you, Dan. It's the audience which makes this show so special. To dive in there. There you'll find the work on completion. You'll find the media coverage of completion and everything else I've been working on, be it localization, be it the global value of copyright. Two subjects which we'll be coming back to on future shows. So, like I say, dive into that website. And from the website, you can reach out to me as well, will@pivotaleconomics.com, with any questions about what we've been discussing or other headwinds and tailwinds facing your business going forward.
Love it. Well, thank you, Will. Appreciate you coming on. And we'll have to share that Mixcloud mix that we got next year and see what 2025 has in store for us. It's only a couple months away.
I know, I'm deep in the engine room of that one, and I'll be coming to you for a shout out for sure.
Can't wait. Thanks, Will. Appreciate it. If you enjoy this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, rate the podcast on Spotify, rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time. If you haven't heard, we're doing it big on Thursday, October 3rd in Los Angeles. That's the date for the Trapital Summit. This is the first summit that Trapital is hosting, and this is going to be the place for the innovators, the builders, and the visionaries that are pushing music and entertainment forward. We have a curated lineup of some of the top leaders in the industry that are doing things big, and they're going to be joining us for fireside chat conversations. You'll hear from Issa Rae, Tunji Balogun from Def Jam, Troy Carter from Venice Music, Kakul Srivastava from Splice, Charisse Clark Suarez from Harborview Equity Partners, Denis Ladegiri from Believe, Elias Seaton from SoundCloud, and more. I am really excited about this, and the thing I'm really excited about is that we're doing things a little bit differently. We've all been to the conferences where there's so many people on stage, so many people that are at the panel. You want to hear from some of them a lot more than others, but no, we're keeping the bar high and we're having deep conversations and real conversations with the people that are actually making moves in this industry. So you can get your tickets now. Tickets are on sale now. You can click the link in our show notes that bring you directly to the website. And anyone listening to this episode can get a 10% discount. Use the code RUNCIE. That's my last name. That's RUNCIE. And get 10% off your ticket. This is going to be a dope event. I'm really excited about it. And I hope you are too. See you there.